conflict. Okay, what's going on? A couple of things for the audience, students and parents, and just people from around the town. You guys could turn off your cell phones and all that kind of stuff. If it rings, it's going to be super loud up here, so just kind of heads up for that. A general rundown of the format. Each person up here is going to have around 5-ish to 15 minutes to speak. I'll be timing you guys on my cell phones, heads up for that. Just sort of like a general opening statement about the topic itself. Speaking of the topic, it is changing climate and the changing economy. After each person speaks, we should have mics I think stationed up in the front. So if any students have a question first, please allow those guys to come up here. In terms of the questions for students, just make sure that it's on topic. Keep it relatively short. We're kind of on a time crunch for this one. If the bell rings, obviously, you can start to head out, but we should be able to be wrapping it up at that point. So, at this point, there was a bit of confusion about who was supposed to show up. So, I'm going to let these guys give the intros for themselves.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. I think I'm one of the people who... I think I'm considered the outlier on the panel. My name is Rebecca Masterman, and I run the University of Minnesota B Squad for the B Lab in Minnesota. And I am charged with working with beekeepers as well as the public and trying to support the health of both honeybees as well as all of the other bees out there. And my background is I have a PhD in entomology. And I studied honeybees in graduate school. And my undergraduate was actually in history. So.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lissa Fries. Says Elizabeth, either one is fine. I am currently a PhD student at MIT. I'm studying atmospheric chemistry. A better way to think about that is that I mostly study air pollution and look at the health as well as somewhat the economic impacts of air pollution around the world. Specifically, I focus on China, the Arctic a little bit, and then the United States as well. Previously, actually, I went to Georgetown for my undergrad and studied international affairs and went and lived in China for a while and worked in Beijing as well as the Tibetan Plateau with a lot of environmental groups. And then moved back to D.C. before starting my Ph.D.
Can you hear me? Is it on?
It's on.
Hi, everyone. My name is Ann Daigle. I live in New Orleans, Louisiana. I am an architect-trained urban planner, strategic planner, and designer. And I work primarily in disaster-related events. I've done a lot of work on the Gulf Coast, post-Katrina. And I've also worked with a crafts apprenticeship program for the preservation crafts with the Princess Foundation out of London. And I've worked in the public and private realms as a city planner, planning director, and also on numerous new urban development projects around the country.
So now time for the opening statements and everything. And if anybody was here last period, I don't know who did the scheduling for this, but I thought we should have maybe started off with this topic and then finished up with the laughter thing, because we're going to go from humor and all that to maybe kind of bumming some people out with some of this stuff. So just kind of bear with us, I suppose. So we'll just kind of go straight down the line. Again, 15 minutes, it's not a hard and fast rule, but just kind of heads up for that.
So I'm actually going to start out talking about bees because my specialty is not climate change, but I will give you some background as far as how bees might work into this topic. So bear with me. Are you all okay with that?
Yeah.
A little bit of bees? Okay. So the world of bees in the United States, we have about 2,500 different species of bees. And the one bee that gets a lot of attention is the European honeybee. And that is the bee that beekeepers manage. And they manage them for honey and wax and other products. But the industry that's related to that bee is really pollination services. So if anybody here likes, anybody like almonds? Mm-hmm. Okay. So we have about 2.6 million honeybee colonies in the United States. About 1.8 million of them are professionally managed. About, actually 2 million are professionally managed. And about 1.8 million are needed in California to pollinate the almonds in February. So when we talk about the bee industry, we are really talking about those commercial beekeepers who are actually quite good at keeping bees alive, although they have had some significant health challenges over the last 10 years. So that's the honeybee industry, and they started in California with the almonds, and then they move on to apples and celery seed. They pollinate a lot of the fruits and vegetables that we eat across the country, blueberries, watermelon, things like that. And then we have to consider all of the other bees out there. Anybody know about how many native bees we have in Colorado? How many different species?
230.
At least one.
Not wrong.
That's true. This is the Price is Right for bees. You have about almost 1,000. So congratulations, Minnesota only has about 460. But when we talk about climate change, that's actually, we're most worried about these native bees. And they actually are very good at pollination services, but we don't put them in boxes and we're not able to truck them around the country. So it's really interesting because climate change can threaten the species that are out there because they might depend upon one flower, and if they don't emerge at the same time as that flower, then we could lose that species. So it's important to know how many bee species you have, and as far as climate change is concerned with these native bees and this European honeybee, there are some predictions that as we go forward, we might need to depend more on the native bees, which is actually not necessarily a bad thing. So a little bit of diversity in the bee world is good.
Okay, so I'm going to start off with a little bit of a story from when I was working in the western part of China, just bordering the Tibetan Plateau. China has a border along its south western area that goes throughout the Himalayas, throughout the plateaus, kind of similar altitude to here. So it was actually interesting coming back here and realizing that I was breathing as heavily here as I was over there, because I live on the East Coast where we are not nearly as high up as you guys are. So when I was working there, I was working with this NGO that does a lot of work with local communities and tries to work with them to preserve their local ecology and to work in the face of climate change, because climate change is affecting especially this region in the plateaus a lot more rapidly than it is throughout other parts of the world because of the altitude and because of how there didn't used to be that much anthropogenic activity there, and it's really impacting this region. And so we would every week spend 1 week in the city, and then I would spend a week out in the plateau living in a yurt and working with this local community, about 10 herdsmen and their families. And the whole point of the program that these NGOs are working on is to develop kind of eco-tours as well as grassland conservation. Because this area used to have grasslands that would be up to kind of your knee or mid-thigh height, and now the grass is maybe an inch or two tall. And when you think about the fact that these people are herdsmen who have, for the past, centuries, relied on this grass and grazing, and their livelihood depends on yaks and cows, and so they used to be kind of nomadic and move around, and they were able to bring their herds everywhere throughout this region. But recently, because of a combination of climate change, which has led to desertification, which is mostly that this grassland is becoming literal desert. I went to a region that used to have the grandfather who ran a local hostel showed me photographs where there was 2 feet high of grass that was there about 30 years ago, and we were standing in that same spot, and it was sand, like no grass whatsoever. So this is really impacting these already impoverished minority communities in China, and this is something you see kind of throughout the world. I wouldn't say this is just one singular example. It's kind of mimicked throughout the world where you're seeing already at-risk communities facing exacerbated issues because of climate change. So most of my work has focused in China, as it clearly makes sense from this example. And I also did a lot of work with the energy growth in China. And so energy in China, as well as the U.S., has traditionally been a lot of fossil fuel-based, which is one of those reasons that we are facing so much climate change, is this carbon dioxide emissions that are leading to increasing temperatures and what we're seeing as far as changes in weather patterns and things like that. And so recently, China has been working a lot on expanding their energy growth as well as their economic reach throughout the world. And so there's a lot of, I'm sure most of you have heard about how much the ice is melting in the Arctic, and that's actually opened a lot of shipping routes through the Arctic. And I was on a panel a couple days ago where we were really focusing in on this, the fact that the Arctic is kind of this new region for economic growth and for potentially energy development. There's a lot of natural gas that is up in the Arctic, oil and gas that can be extracted, again, for more energy. But the big questions that arise are, should we continue to kind of extract this oil and gas that's causing climate change when it is the reason that we can access it now in the Arctic is because of climate change? And so there's a lot of contention back and forth as far as economic opportunities that arise because of climate change, and then also economic hindrances that arise because of climate change. And who's facing those burdens tend to be a lot of those more impoverished, already marginalized communities, and who is going to benefit may not be those people. I'll leave it at that.
Thanks. Okay. our title here is economic effects or impacts of climate change, and of course we've seen these too, primarily agriculture. The whole map of global architecture is going to change, which is going to impact every country on earth. There's going to be much more immigration and internal migration. Some impacts are going to be permanent, others will be temporary. Some might even be beneficial. It would be kind of interesting to grow avocados in Kansas City. All of that said, there are local impacts that are going to happen to you here and that happen. My focus is primarily on the physical environment, where we live, where human beings live, but also maintaining pristine natural resources and the environment to protect us, because I believe in a concept called the transect, the rural to urban transect, in which everything is connected. Everything is interconnected. If you impact one thing, if you do a little tug here, it's going to impact it all the way down the line. So we have to protect our bees. I also happen to be a pecan farmer. We have a farm in northeast Louisiana. We grow cotton and wheat that's there, but pecans primarily, and it impacts us. We plant clover underneath the pecans so that it attracts the bees. As far as the built environment is concerned, where it's going to impact you the most, it's going to change where you get your food, how you get it, how much it costs. It's going to impact already your shopping arrangement. Everybody knows already the malls are failing all over. I think that it's all related. The way we live, we have sprawled our country out so that it's completely unsustainable economically, financially, socially, physically. It makes us miserable when we're in our cars all the time. If you don't know that now, you will. You will learn that. So we're depending on you guys. We need you young people to really learn about this and decide how you can contribute to either changing the status quo or making it worse. We, in the work that I do, it's all based on resilience. Resiliency, we never called it that, but it's in creating the walkable urban environments that something like 60% of the population in America says they want, but it's completely not available. And in fact, it is illegal, even here in Boulder. You could not build New Orleans again, which is fabulous. From where I live, I can walk to cafes. I have a dog vet and a cat vet. I have 4 grocery stores. I have anything that I want, to from movie theaters, parks, everything within walking distance, a 5-minute walking distance of where I live. I can meet all of my needs plus. I don't know how many people in America can say that. Originally, that's the way we were built. We were built around central squares that included government, religious or philosophical institutions, and the marketplace. And those three were intertwined, and they worked together collaboratively to grow communities. We didn't have to have zoning that literally, well, and I say this, but it's legally enforced segregation by both economics and social. So those are big issues. This is a huge subject, and economically, it's going to impact you guys the most. And I'm a baby boomer. I helped create it. My parents set up the system. We perfected it, and it is horrible. I'm working, hoping that I can work now to change it, and I'm hoping that my children and that you all and that my grandchild, too, I have one grandchild right now, will make those changes that are necessary. And I'm sure we'll get into more of how we can do this later.
Absolutely. So now, if students have any questions, you guys can start stacking up here at the front. Again, there's a mic right there. I think there's a mic over there if you guys can see it. If you want to take just like a few minutes to kind of think of some stuff. But if there's anything you kind of like off the top of your head, please feel free to start walking up here. When you do, guys, for one thing, like when you get to the mic, state your name and the group that you are in. Okay, and hopefully it's a straightforward question. I'm just kind of keep in mind, too, that it's not a platform or anything like that. So, are there any takers to start us off with? That's not all right at once.
Not that scary.
Yeah, so like this was the problem, is that there was a bunch of people that had a bunch of questions about humor and so forth. This one, I don't know. Okay, we got a couple? There you go.
Yeah.
So, I was wondering about how infrastructure might change in order to deal with the changing climate. For example, the Dutch have been changing the way they dive circles to take into account the more varied weather patterns and like rising sea levels, and they're also building new canals and such. And what is the situation of the bigger context for this, both maybe in the U.S. or like generally, what will have to change in the infrastructure? Will we end up living in this new reality like this? Is it advisable to try to prepare for what is going to be an inevitability rather than try to sort of what seems like a less possible prospect of saving it off?
Well, good question. I like to say that today, pretty much, we react to everything rather than proactively plan. And I think it's the most important thing we need to do. Infrastructure, as we all know, is in terrible shape in this country, unlike in other countries of the world. They have made those investments. We have to reconsider our priorities. Number one, I think, is to invest in a really good, sustainable transportation infrastructure. That means get out of our cars. We need to build both heavy and light rail. We need to invest in clean forms of electrical vehicles. We need to put in those sidewalks where they don't exist because we need to use our feet and our bicycles more. It's healthier for us. It makes for a better community. We need to make sure that I include infrastructure, I include a street network in that infrastructure, because unless you have a street network, you can't have a compact community where you, like I have in New Orleans. Our average block size is 350 feet. So it's very easy to walk to just about anything. There was something else I wanted to say about infrastructure. Oh, the other thing is as far as priorities, I don't think that in adaptation we are going to, or we should, spend a lot of money trying to protect those places. There is really no hope. I have lots of friends from Miami. That's actually where I used to work out of, and they're all leaving. They know that it's already flooding. And in a few years, most of Florida won't be there. The Everglades, you know, is all wetlands. South Louisiana won't. The only reason I think New Orleans might stay there is because it is at the delta of one of the largest watersheds in the entire world. And it literally covers two-thirds of the country, and we can use that as shipping, which is a much cleaner form of transportation and freight.
I'll add one little thing onto that, because I think that energy structure really ties a lot into a sustainable future and kind of infrastructure, is that it's really important also that when we think about the money that we're investing into the future of energy, that rather than investing in cleaning up old coal plants or putting in place new plants that are going to continue to keep us in this fossil fuel burning focused mindset, that we really start shifting our mindset and focusing on the next generation of technology and really improving. One of the huge barriers right now is that we need better battery storage for solar and wind power. So investing a lot in that. And so a lot of it is the question of when you're, you don't have all of the money in the world to invest in future sustainable infrastructure. So we need to pick and choose and make sure that what we're putting the money into is going to bring us the most impactful and most long-term sustainable options.
Right. I'm going to take license with the word infrastructure because I'm a liar. When it comes to farms, I just want to say that the kind of the neat movement that's going on right now is that farmers, I think they were our first environmentalists, and the way agriculture has grown so much, a lot of the land use practices became detrimental to the land. And the good news is that now there are so many farmers out there who are investing in their land, in the way they set it up, so that there's strips for pollinators and beneficial insects, and there are buffer strips that take care of water and protect the land from runoff. And I think that there's a very nice movement that will set up farms to protect themselves against some of the climate change that is occurring. And as far as the bees are concerned, these changes will also support better diversity. Some bees like to forage when it's windy, some bees will forage when it's colder, and some bees need different conditions. And so when you have that diversity of pollinators that are supported by the land, that's going to help the future. And hopefully it's not too late and we're not reacting, but they are being proactive. I'm the entomologist, so I'm going there. So, pesticides, what a controversial topic to bring up. I will say that when we think about pesticides, there are organic pesticides that that organic certified organic farms will use. There are synthetic pesticides that are more akin to the pests becoming resistant to them. So pesticides is a really big category. And unfortunately, a lot of pesticides are very bad for humans because they act on the synapses that impact humans as well as the same neurotransmitters that impact insects. We share a lot in common with a lot of bugs, everybody. But the truth is that at this point, we don't have a system set up so that we can produce enough food where we're at, and we don't. We have a lot of people who do not have access to healthy food, and so our system is I think broken is a good word to use, and we have a lot of work to go so that we can reduce pesticide use and still provide good, clean, healthy food for people. Pesticides, I think that my biggest issue as an entomologist and looking at pesticides is that if it is a use that's for human health and for food safety, I get that and support it, and always with the goal of reducing use. If it is to make my flowers really pretty in my yard, if it's to keep out dandelions, then I think that we really need to reconsider our use of cosmetic pesticides. And I don't know how to tie that into climate change or economics. So I'm just going to probably stop there. But it's a good question. But I will say that when there's something like a pesticide, for instance, a lot of people don't like neonicotinoids, and they were actually developed so that the people applying the pesticides would have a safer application. And so it's just not all black and white. There's this big gray area of how pesticides are used and if they're safe for humans or if they're safe for pollinators. And so we have to look at the big picture when we think about that.
Well, I'll say they're not safe for humans. I live in Louisiana, which is at the delta, again, of that river, and all of the insecticides and the pesticides and the
thank you. We're giving them to you.
Everything comes from Minnesota. down the Mississippi River, ends up in the delta. Yeah. It kills off a lot of organisms. We have problems with, you know, our shrimp harvest. So it impacts, you know, in our oysters, it impacts people's income. Mm-hmm. The other thing, grow your own vegetables. You can eat dandelion greens.
And I just throw in from the more, I guess, earth science perspective, if you're talking about pesticides, or in our case, we often think about fertilizer. And if you, this is a very basic, but if you're putting in a lot of fertilizer, you're totally going to throw off, especially as the runoff goes into the water. There's very important nitrogen cycles, which I'm sure you'll get to learn about in science class. But the nitrogen cycle is really, really critical to keeping our climate and our ecosystems healthy. And once you start getting significant amounts of nitrogen runoff, you're going to really impact that, and that's not at all.
Groundwater.
And I'll add that the good news about pesticides is that you are all decision makers as far as how they're used in the future. The farmers are literally doing what we're telling them to do because of how we're purchasing things. And so if you believe that you want only organic pesticides to be used, then you need to then support organic materials or organic products. And so there's so much power in this room to decide our future use of pesticides. It's something that I hope that you take with you and you make some decisions based upon knowing that you guys get to decide the health of the country in the future.
Who knows about cows and other things?
All right, I'll try my best. I'm not at all a commercial meat industry expert, but I have mostly from the kind of air pollution and emission standpoint. Yeah, the main impact of the commercial meat industry is going to be methane emissions. And so especially in a state like Colorado, where you already have a very large oil and gas industry, but you also have a very large kind of agricultural output. And when you start coupling together a lot of methane emissions, it leads to a lot of localized impacts as well as global impacts. So I think that's the most critical way to think about it, is through methane emissions. I unfortunately can't talk too much more in detail just because that's not my field, but.
Well, and in my area of the country, Mississippi and Louisiana, we raise an awful lot of chicken and pork, and it impacts the groundwater, and of course, it doesn't smell so good either from that methane. But industrial farming, we have to stop that practice. If you go to Europe and you see these wonderful farms that right on the edge of the cities, they raise most things organically. They don't allow a lot of the things we do here in the United States, and we are really far behind the rest of the world in that aspect, I think.
I'll throw one more thing in. Is that, kind of building on that, something that scientists always need in order to look at emissions and really make an understandable contribution to figuring out how to move forward from these things is data. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of accurate data on methane emissions or in general emissions from agriculture or industrial large meat production, just because of certain laws that are in place kind of protecting from that data acquisition.
And it goes again back to your buying power. So when you're buying your meat, you can buy meat from smaller operations. The for pollinators, for bees and other insects that pollinate, one of the biggest challenges has been the change in land over time has taken away a lot of their food. The United States used to support like 5.5 million honeybee colonies. And if we don't need 5.5 million honeybee colonies right now, but if we tried to put them out there, our land would absolutely not support it. And so it goes to, it's a really good question, but it goes to a bigger question of how are we raising our food. And it's amazing what you can do in your backyard as far as helping to supplement your diet. And if the cool thing about pollinators too is that if you decide that you don't maybe want to plant for bees, but you just want to plant your own fruits and vegetables, well, guess what? You've just planted for bees. I mean, you're not just putting food out there for yourself, but you're supporting a really diverse insect community.
One thing to add to that I always think is interesting when we do talk about kind of the future of food, is that especially being in somewhere like Boulder, there is access to kind of those yards and that ability to have almost this more farm-to-table outlook. But oftentimes, especially as we look at the future growth of not only in the U.S., but around the world, most people are living in urban situations where they don't have that access. So that is always a thought about how do we ensure that we are not only producing sustainable food, but enough food for people who are living in these more urban situations where they don't have necessarily access to that. I'm sure you have.
Okay, everybody,
interesting.
Come to Minneapolis, St. Paul, because we have so many we have so many places where like houses have been pulled down, and then 0.25 acres or 0.11 acres where it used to be a house, they have put in a community garden. So we have huge community garden access. I guess land isn't as sparse as it is here. So you're all welcome to Minnesota. We can fit all of you. University of Minnesota is a great option.
trying to limit insecticides and change the way we grow things and how the environment is changing. You were saying growing down cars in Kansas City. What about GMOs and altering vegetables and things that we're growing and making them more resistant to disease and other things that we don't need insecticides and maybe make them so that more bees are more likely to come to these plants and we can grow it up. But in Boulder, where we are, it's big insecticides. We can't try to kill the animals here. In the next town over, Longmont, we must kill them. We're able to take it. I'm just curious what your feelings with GMOs, because it's quite a hot button topic here. Understand?
Well, I'm just going to say off the bat, I personally don't have a problem with them. I have not seen where they are negative, and they're using, even though they're, I think it's an emotional thing. I don't think that there's the science there to prove that they're detrimental. And when that happens, of course, we can address it. But I think that the benefits far outweigh the.
So is it more of an ethical?
Oh,
is it more ethics that we're saying what is changing the tomato, changing the lemon, it's not growing what it's supposed to be, we're altering it? You think, or is it that while we're resisting protecting ourselves?
So since I'm doing my PhD, I'm still taking classes like a lot of the students here are. And I'm actually taking a really interesting class on the intersection of science, technology and policy, and we just had a discussion about GMOs, and a lot of the discussion was based off the fact that there's actually a lot of different technologies when you're looking at genetically modifying, and in some cases, people who are using certain technologies don't even qualify the way in which they are modifying an organism as genetically modified, as a GMO. And so a lot of the discussion right now is about, rather than looking at narrowing things down into this specific genetically modified organism through that process, looking at the product that you're getting, and if that product is something that you would naturally be able to get, and that would be able to come through a lot of more tedious, long-term, slower processes of breeding rather than genetically doing it. There's a lot of arguments for kind of exempting those from GMO qualifications. And so the question of what product you're going to have, I don't think it's necessarily as much an ethical question as it is a concern about, in general, further human modification of something that is otherwise to us a natural aspect of our dietary intake. But we've been modifying organisms for a really long time. You look at the banana that we have, that we purchase in the United States, that has been modified dramatically by breeding for decades. And so those questions of the exact process kind of tend to be the blurry line.
Yeah, and I'll just quickly say, apples too. One of our first GMOs. The GMOs in bees gets really tricky because I haven't seen any data that support that they're at all hurting bees, and yet there's a strong movement across the country that people who do not want GMOs. And I'm going to sound like a broken record, which. Do you guys know what a record is?
No,
I'm kidding. Sorry. I get to say that. That was funny. You had humor. That was funny. But there's a... sorry. But there's... If you go to the store, you see the result of people not wanting to purchase GMOs because it's on labels all over the place. So it's the power of how you pay for things. And so certain things have been tied to bees. And that's where we get stuck, because when it comes to bees, we're not able to say, yes, get rid of the GMOs. You might have other reasons for them, which, again, it's a personal thing.
Yeah, so I think we panel on laughter and humor gave us all sparkling water bottles up here.
I think they shook them.
They were trying to do it.
Be careful. I'm holding on.
Yeah. I didn't notice what happened to me.
So how should we provide an incentive to massive capitalist companies who have no reason to change other than moral? And is our current system of publicly traded companies compatible with an ideal environmentally based system?
What grade are you in? I'm sorry.
10th grade. Wow. Okay.
So how can we reconcile environmental change with capitalism?
Okay. So I'll bring a kind of neat example to talk about that. There's this really cool environmental NGO that I got to do some work with in China, and they have this phone app because they were kind of trying to tap into the younger generations to get people more involved. And this app allows people who live throughout all of China to go, and if they pass by, you can kind of see a lot of factories. It's where most of our goods that we buy are produced in China, and now throughout Southeast Asia, because it's a lot cheaper to produce there. Mostly, it was cheaper to produce there because they were allowed to pollute a lot more than we allowed pollution here. And also, labor costs are a lot lower there. And so this app allowed people to take pictures and report when they saw a plant that they thought was polluting more than they should be. And so the NGO that was doing this then created a blacklist of these plants. And what they did is then they tied those plants to companies, like global companies that were using those factories and those plants to produce their goods. And the Chinese government picked up on it and saw it and kind of backed them on this anti-pollution campaign. And it ended up making it so that Nike shifted and pulled out of a number of factories, as did Apple. And they stopped using a huge number of factories that were violating a lot of pollution laws within China. And that was solely because of a 10-person small NGO and a lot of really interested and invested citizens who were like, we don't want this pollution in our neighborhood. We don't want this dirty water running through our rivers. We don't want to be breathing all the pollutants that you're emitting. And so I think, in general, that is, as you've been saying, as we tie it back to this kind of economic push, is I've seen a lot lately. There's a lot of trends for kind of more environmentally conscious clothing, as well as home goods and things like that. And that's become a huge trend, and that's because people are demanding it. And so a lot of capitalism is really based off of your consumer, because you're only going to do as well as your consumer is going to buy your goods. So if consumers continue to demand of their businesses and of their favorite companies that they continue to push for change in this realm as far as pollution and climate, then I think that's going to be a huge impact. And you've seen that a lot also with the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Climate Treaty. Instead, we've seen actually individual companies sign on as best they can to the Paris Climate Treaty. So that's a really neat trend, is to see at the private business level commitments towards changing the outlook on the environment. Because in the end, a lot of this in the past has been something that companies were able to make less expensive goods. But in return, we, everyone in the local communities, were bearing the cost of that through climate change, through pollution, things like that. And now instead, they're internalizing those costs. They're taking those costs on themselves and incorporating that into the future of their energy production, of their, you look at the gene dyeing industry and how they've completely transformed in the past 10 years.
Do we have to that? And I think what you touched on, as far as the climate treaty, a lot of governors of states signed their states on to conform. And that is something I think we haven't hit on yet, but some of you get to vote soon. sooner than others, but voting or getting into office yourselves, that's how you can make a huge difference and decide on who's going to lead us into protecting our environment and supporting and actually preparing us for environmental issues that are going to come ahead.
And just to also bounce off of that whole voting side of things, also keeping involved and calling representatives and making sure your voice is heard is really critical. Because that actually, when they're in office, is what keeps them moving forward. And that also is something when you think about kind of putting in place regulations and making sure that emissions are controlled so that climate change isn't exacerbated and that we are actually taking care of the issue right now. In order for that to happen, not only do we need people pushing for that and calling their representatives and making sure that legislation is going in place, but also we need to understand that in the end, a lot of the movement forward, it's not going to be necessarily easy to transition a lot of different fields. There's going to be hard times, especially we're seeing a lot of kind of backlash against regulations on air pollution and emissions from coal plants because it's putting there's kind of statements that it's putting coal plants out of business. But in general, there's not been a lot of actual findings that regulations on emissions and air pollution are really actually putting businesses out, especially with coal. There's mostly, in many senses, competition is putting other businesses out. And regulations also end up potentially creating new jobs in cleaner industries or in enforcing regulations and things like that. So ensuring both ends of that deal are put into place is really important.
Okay, I would just like to say that capitalism is a wonderful, wonderful thing if the playing field is level. Right now in America, it has run amok. And it is up to the individuals and smaller organizations to bring it around. I very firmly believe in the opportunities that are available for a Green New Deal. And this is the way that we can work together and come up with locally based options. And I personally think that every city should have a Green New Deal. It shouldn't be some national umbrella. There maybe could be money given to cities to make this happen, where individuals can be involved, neighborhood organizations can get involved, and your vote and how you spend your money is critical.
My question is, so I've seen in the news stuff about flooding from storms like Hurricane Katrina, Sandy, Houston a few years back. Do you know what impacts these storms have had on the state economy and what sort of urban development other cities have taken advantage of?
Well, having worked in three states, every one of them was different. Mississippi was a Republican-controlled state. Louisiana was Democratic-controlled. Politics had an awful lot to do with how much money came in and how fast it came in. Disasters require a national response. But the money that was spent, the billions of dollars that was spent post-Katrina is never going to happen again. We just can't afford it. We really cannot afford it. So I think what's going to happen in the future is that more cities and states are going to be responsible for putting in regulations so that people don't build in areas that are too low, so that farms aren't in places where they shouldn't be, that industry isn't. Insurance is already doing it. The market is already doing it. The first thing that happened in Mississippi post-Katrina was that insurers would not insure houses. They wouldn't insure businesses. That was a big deal. they had to move out of the floodplain or self-insure, which a lot of them did. This is such a big issue, but we don't have the money to do this. We have to define our priorities, and we have to make really tough decisions about where we're going to spend our money and where we're going to choose to settle. And I don't know. It's a tough one. They're not talking about it either. Nobody's talking about this.
I've got nothing.
So, guys, just to say one more question.
Cool. This wasn't so much economic, but it related to what Liz Smith was talking about, where these pastoral groups are experiencing difficulties. Once climate change sort of maybe eliminates these cultural groups, what will the cultural fabric of the world look like, and how will it look different? What will be the most striking changes there?
Culturally? Yeah, culturally. Yeah, so when I think about things culturally, as I was saying, a lot of the groups that are facing more immediate changes are going to be your already marginalized or minority communities. So I think that as far as social and in that case, sometimes also political stability goes, there's going to be a lot of increased tensions as we see these minority populations facing increased economic impacts, as well as just cultural changes to historically significant ways of living. In the specific example I was giving, I think it's always easier to kind of view things in one specific light. These communities are Tibetan identifying, but they are actually within Chinese territory. And so this is a very already impoverished and marginalized community in the sense that there is very little support for infrastructure growth in their area, and there's a lot of tension between these Tibetan groups and the Chinese government. And so if you're looking at potential economic impacts on them, and as these communities begin to see further changes because of climate change and see their culture that they already view as being pretty dampened by an already very intense political situation, as their culture has further changed because of more impacts that are out of their reach, especially since they're really not contributing to climate change, not nearly as much as we are, and the rest of China is as well. You're going to see a lot of more tensions begin to rise as these communities kind of have to grapple with the loss of historically significant cultural practices, cultural relics, as we see sea levels rise. There's a lot of potential impacts.
I have to say, despite the challenges, I think it's the most exciting time ever in the world and in our country. I think there's so much opportunity out there to develop culture because it is more diverse and because our communities or our populations are. I work on a project that I've been doing for 3 years now with the Kresge Foundation and the Knight Foundation on what we're calling lean urbanism. And it's actually targeted toward immigrants, young people, and boomers that want a different lifestyle, somebody like me. So the idea is that you go in and you get down and you do things at the grassroots together. Individually, you would take out a lot of the roadblocks, financial, bureaucratic roadblocks that are in place. You adopt what we call a lean, a pink code. I don't know why I got that. I think because we think of codes as being red, but this is a pink code. and you incentivize do-it-yourself projects, incentivize entrepreneurship, get people to be independent and do their own things. And one of the things that I've been focusing on is the great opportunity we have to reclaim existing small towns that have been deserted. There's been disinvestment in them for years, and yet they have great bones. They have wonderful small streets. They have street trees, beautiful landscapes. Most of them have agriculture on the edge. They have gorgeous historic architecture that needs work. It's a great opportunity for young people to invest in those areas. And in fact, if you want to see something really interesting, four girls from that had been college buddies and their husbands were musicians decided that they couldn't afford the town they wanted to live in, so they all moved to this little bitty town called Water Valley, Mississippi. These girls ended up in the New York Times because single-handedly they completely turned that little town around. They opened a grocery store, which led to an organic farm being done. This is all by women. And they opened galleries and started having events. It started attracting a lot of other people from other countries and a real diversity of population. Now the men have opened a brewery. That was the first thing that they did. And then they also opened a bed and breakfast there. They did all the renovations themselves, which was really interesting. It was a lot of, blood and sweat they put into it, I guess. But I just think that it's such an opportunity, and I think we need to think about that because we're not going to be on the coast, and we need to reclaim all that inland infrastructure, which, by the way, is also on rail lines. So if we can get passenger rail again, we're going to be in great shape.
Great.
All right. So it seems like go ahead. The takeaway for today is that the change starts with us and with you guys out there. Okay, like both like at like the marketplace and obviously in politics as well. Okay, so we have like a minute left. Quick round of applause for everybody here. You guys.